Okay, today is December 25th. All classes go on as scheduled. And today we're going to close out our discussion in Sefer Bereishis of parents and children. And our first call to order is to learn why Yaakov was so quick to accept Yehuda's offer of watching over Binyamin, but he didn't accept Reuven's offer. Now, Reuven's offer was quite absurd, right?
Why?
Okay, but he should have just understood Reuven's offer not to say that you can console yourself for losing a second child by killing two grandsons, but that I'm so sure that I will bring him back. A few people in Bereishis talk this way. Yaakov says, I'm so sure, Lavan, that none of my company took your idols, right? That the one who took it should die. And that's exactly what happened to him. Or when Yehuda says at the end of last week's parsham, we're so sure that none of us took that cup, that if one of us did, that one should die and the rest of us will be slaves. Right? Yosef's offer in the end was downright charitable compared to that. Mm-hmm. Right? All right, so when Reuven says you can kill my two sons if I don't bring them back, he's just being pachas kamayim, like he's acting Reuven-like. But first thing I'd like to do is to take a trip way down to the end of Tanakh. I see some Tanakhs on the table. It's going to be page 1884 in the Tanakhs. The rest of you will start to open up to gracious Mem Gimel. Okay, we're reading page 1884 at the very top of the page, the top line. Divrei HaYamim lists the main biblical characters from Adam Rishon to Ezra. Right? And along the way, it lists Yaakov's 12 sons and their children. So it says in Perek Hei Pasuk Aleph, page 1884, the top of the page, U'bnei Reuven Bechor Yisrael. Reuven was the firstborn of Israel, ki hu ha-bechor. Good reason. U'v'chalalo Yitzu'ei Aviv, and when he defiled his father's bed, however you understand that, how you want to understand that, Nitzna bechorato livnei Yosef. His bechor was given, doesn't say to Yosef, it was given to the sons of Yosef. Right? In what way? Very simple. Pishnayim. He received the two tribes. Right?
What did they receive, Rabbi?
He received them, Yaakov tells him that in the beginning of this week's parsha. He tells him, I've given you Shechem Echot Alachecha. You have gotten one portion above your brothers. That's the birthright portion. You were the firstborn of Rachel. And you were the firstborn that I always wanted. Right? If Rachel was Yaakov's first wife and she gave birth to Yosef alone, there wouldn't have been a Mechiras Yosef. Right? That's how they say our Ami Oved Avi, right? Okay, Velo Lihityaches Lebechora. Right? Although, what does that mean? But not to be have a yichus of the bechora, because the bechora should also have been the melech, right? That's what I'm saying. That because of the next pasuk, it says ki Yehuda gavar be'echav ulenogiv mimenu v'habechora liyosef. There are three different dinim here. There's Reuven, who gets the Bechorah even later in the Torah in so far as he's usually mentioned first. He lines up first in the desert, he's mentioned first in all the Nisim, right? Actually, the Nisim Yehuda is mentioned first, I should say, but you see, when they make reckonings in the desert, usually in Sefer Bamidbar, Reuven's counted first, right? Yaakov blesses Reuven first, right?
But lo lehityaches could refer to something, one other thing, couldn't it? When Joseph asks Yaakov to give the blessing to Menashe and Ephraim, he gives the wrong way. And Joseph asks to correct it. He says, no, no, this doesn't count anymore. Right?
Doesn't count to be a Bechor anymore. Bechor doesn't mean anything anymore.
That's what Yaakov says.
It's not
going
to mean anything to... Right? It hardly ever meant anything in Sefer Bereishis.
The sons, there's right. No now. There's no right. Fourth patriarch. The sons right. Are all inherit. No one is a patriarch. It's right. All B'nai Israel. There's no more right. Avot.
It's true. The truth of your generation, too. Okay, so Yehuda gavar be'echov u'nagid mimenu v'abachoro liYosef. So Yehuda is the Melech, the Bechora is to Yosef, he gets two tribes, right? Mm-hmm. And let's go back to Bereishis Perek Nun Gimel. So Reuven and Yehuda both tried to convince their father to let Binyamin go. Binyamin's opinion is not mentioned in the Torah. Did he go over to his father and say, Daddy, let me go. I'll be careful. I mean, Reuven argues, I'll watch him. Yehuda says, I'll watch him. How about Binyamin? What did he have to say? Daddy, I'm particular. I have 10 children myself. Binyamin's no kid now. He's not a 12-year-old. He has 10 children himself. More than any other of the Yaakov's children, by the way. Right? At no point does Yehuda beseech on behalf of this of Binyamin for the sake of his 10 potential orphans. Right? The simple answer for that is because Yehuda did not make himself responsible to Binyamin. He made himself responsible to his father. Right? Okay, let's start. Perek Mem Gimel, Pasuk. I want to start with Pasuk Chet. Okay, if you have the full Tanakh, it's just about page 108 at the bottom of the page. Okay. So last week we did what Reuven said. We all know the absurdity of it. It's so absurd that we know that he didn't mean it. Right? When you know I'm exaggerating, right? I can exaggerate. Right? It's called the Derech HaFlogo. Okay. I'll tell you, sometimes it sounds like the Talmud is exaggerating on something, and you'll find someone that says, no, it's not an exaggeration at all. Okay? When the Gemara says a person should rather jump into a furnace than embarrass someone publicly, is that really a halachic statement? Because ostensibly you're going to die when you jump in. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right, so comes Tosfos and says, so why wasn't it listed in the things you should rather die than violate? So Tosfos answers, well, there are other Tosfos says it's not mafurish in the pasuk, not to embarrass someone publicly, or like some other mafurishim say, it's already one of the three. Embarrassing someone publicly is killing him. So then we'll press the envelope. Really, if someone puts a gun to your head and say, embarrass that person or I'll kill you, you should rather. Or furthermore, are you a Rodef? Are you allowed to kill someone to stop him from embarrassing another person? Because mm-hmm. you're allowed to kill someone to stop them from killing another person.
Yeah,
are you allowed to kill someone to stop them from embarrassing another person?
I don't think so.
That would be an amazing thing to tell the judge. Or the Sanhedrin. Right? So what does the Gemara mean? So the Gemara is Derech HaFloga. So Reuven says, yeah, I was Derech HaFloga too. I didn't mean you should take my shoes. Come on, don't get crazy with me. Right? Yes.
But the Mishneh Torah it also says you can embarrass people. Like a teacher can embarrass the student to teach them the material. So then it's not like really murder because, or you're allowed to murder sometimes.
Okay. I wouldn't call it murder then. Okay. Alright. Okay, so let's see what Yehuda has to say.
Right.
Lemi Hudel Yisrael Aviv. Shilcho ha-na'ar iti v'nakuma v'neilecha. Send him with me, my responsibility. Now there are a lot of brothers. They're all older than him, but you know, Yehuda says, he steps forward. Now where's Shimon and Levi? But okay, they don't step forward. But Yehuda does. It's not like Shimon and Levi were never able to go out and mate and take responsibility. They took quite a bit of responsibility for their sister.
Yeah, but their father wasn't happy with it, so that's why they did it. Not stepping
forward. And
Dina
was no threat to them, you know. So okay, so Yehuda says. Maybe it's because he feels guilty because he was the one who suggested to sell Yosef. Right? We'll live and we won't die. Us and you two dead and all of our children. Why are you putting your son ahead of all your grandchildren? Right? It's an important word here. I am going to Erven. You ever hear of Kol Yisrael Aravim Zebazer, right?
Yeah, pledge.
I will, so, Eravon. So, Leon just hit exactly on an amazing makor. Gracious Rabba asks, what event took place in Yehuda's life for which the Medrash says, this man is worthy to be king?
Tamar.
Right. It's Yehuda and Tamar. It's Tamar's story, not this.
Well, he gives a pledge there.
Because he gives a pledge there also. So there's an Eravon there. You see, Yehuda is slowly, slowly, throughout Sefer Bereishis, after that unfortunate, perhaps one of the worst of, parts of our history, because it involved everybody, right? Binyamin was a little baby, but involved all of us. So Yehuda, in the first story in Bereishis Lamed Ches, if you turn back with me, is that he loses a son. Right? Okay. And look what he tells his surviving son what he should do. He says in Pasuk Ches, page 94, Lamed Ches Ches, 38:8. Vayomer Yehuda la'onan. Bo el eishes ochicha, v'yabei mosa, v'hakem zera le'ochicha. See what he's doing? He says, v'yabei yudilo alone. Bo el eishes ochicha. He doesn't give it a name. He doesn't say bo el eishes heir. Bo el eishes ochicha, v'yabei mosa, v'hakem zera le'ochicha. You see what he's trying to do? Is it possible that Yehuda just fabricated this idea of levirate marriage? No. I've seen...
Where is that? I'm sorry.
Must have been...
Lamed Ches Ches, 38:8.
Okay.
This idea of levirate marriage was known in the ancient world, but there is a family that seems to practice it earlier in Bereishis. It's not exactly as we know it from the Torah, but neither is this. The father-in-law ultimately practices it. And the cousin practices it in the Book of Rus. Right, you all know what I'm talking about. Yibum.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I would tell you that it seems that Avraham's family practices it as well. Because Terach has three sons. Haran, Nahor, and Avraham.
Uh-huh.
Right? Now, it's not such a stretch to say that Yiska was Sarah. Yiska means princess in Aramaic. Sarah means princess in Hebrew. They came from Aram. They moved to across the river, Avraham Nahar, and they speaking Hebrew, Avram HaIvri, right? So it stands to reason that her name changed from Yiska to Sarah, right? Who was Yiska's father? Haran. Who was Nahor married to? Yes. A different daughter of
Milka.
Haran. Milka. So Haran dies, and his two brothers marry their daughters. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Not his wife, but they marry the daughters to keep the Haran name. Right? It's not the classical levirate marriage we know from the Torah. Levirate marriage is marrying the wife of the man who dies. But in this case, the two brothers are each marrying the two daughters that this man leaves behind. The idea was common enough in the ancient world, even in the time of the Gemara. Where marriage to one's niece was common. Okay, so Yehuda says, so he's not, he doesn't initiate this idea, but in doing so, he is asking a brother to do something quite unselfish. Look, in the ancient world, excuse the tangent on Maseches Yevamos, but in the ancient world, many societies, and I believe there are some even today, when a woman's husband dies, she is never to remarry. Sometimes she goes and dies with him.
Right? Well, that's Indian culture, Sati.
Yeah. In China.
Yeah. So I'm just saying, it's still practiced. But in the ancient world, or especially if a woman was divorced, she can't marry again. In many ancient cultures. Torah says, the Torah law, there's no such restriction. But when a woman, so if a woman is divorced, so okay, she wants to be married to someone else. But when a woman's husband dies, especially if he dies childless, and Stami was young, she wants very much, she would love very much to still be married to him. But she wants to have a child, and she might want to name the child after the first husband. Mm-hmm. But what man wants to be married to a woman every time she calls her his son's name, she's thinking of another man? Mm-hmm. Right? So there is someone who is open to that, his brother.
Yeah.
His brother is open to such a thing because I also miss him. I also want his name to be remembered. So even though I recognize I am the second choice of the woman I'm married to, right? But I'll treat her well and I'll name a child after the husband she might, for the rest of our marriage, admit she'd rather be married to. But reality is reality and here I am. Right? So Torah is realistic. And so here, Yehuda is telling his son, take your brother's wife, act like a brother. Because Lord knows, not too many siblings, not too many brothers in this book act like a brother. And I'm saying that in all directions. We don't get along as brothers, we're not getting along in this book. So Yehuda is even, I must tell you, if you could just turn back just one page, actually, page 92 in the Tanakh. You turn back one page. So when Yehuda, Reuven saves Yosef from them, right? But he's pachas kamayim again. He puts him in a pit, and he doesn't do anything to actually save him. So look what it says in Pasuk Chavav, the last line. It says, "Vayomer Yehuda lechav, ma betza ki naharog es ochinu." He doesn't say, ma betza ki narogo es Yosef, ki narogo so, or something. V'chisinu es damo, l'chuvanim krenu l'yishma'elim, v'yodenu al tihibo, ki ochinu v'sarenu hu. You see, even in Yehuda's wickedness, if I can say, even in his, you know, he's the one who sells him, right? In the next chapter, let's assume that it's in the proper order. In the next chapter, Yehuda leaves home. Rashi says the brothers just reamed into him because they blamed him for the sale. Goes, what? You guys wanted to kill him! If I didn't say to sell him, he would certainly be dead. At least now maybe we'll find him someplace. Right? So they said, no. The reason why we blame his disappearance on you is because if you had said to bring him home, we would have listened. Mm. So you're responsible for not saying that. Mm. It's a burden, but okay, yes.
Did the brothers expect Yosef to die when he was thrown in the pit, or did they expect Hashem to make a miracle? Because Daniel, you know, when he was thrown into the lions, he survived.
Daniel was thrown into a pit that the Tanakh says had lions in it. The medrash that says that this pit had snakes and scorpions in it is a fine medrash because of the extraneous verbiage in the pasuk v'habor reik ein b'mayim. Hello, I know if it's empty, of course it doesn't have water. Well, that means it didn't have water, but it must have had something else. All right, that's there are all kinds of drashas about what that means and how that fits, but how long he was in the pit is not clear. Okay, but what I'm trying to point out is that Yehuda twice, when asking his son to do this levirate marriage, he says, he's your brother, go to do this to your brother. He says it twice. And here, when he's saving Yosef, he also manages to say, after all, he's my brother. Now, there's one other place like this where Yosef is looking for them, and maybe he recognizes, I have not been behaving properly, and I need to seek out the peace of my brethren. Because Yaakov says, go to Shechem, right, and seek is Shlomachecha. And then he says, Esachai ani mevakesh. He tells that stranger, right? Okay, all right, so then the mob took over, and then we know what happened. All right, let's go back to Perek Mem Gimel. And Yehuda is the one who's at least trying to save. Oh, no, I'm sorry. No, I still need Perek Lamed Ches. Sorry. So, because notice that when he needs some comfort, his wife just died, he lost two sons, he sees a woman by the road, and he sees a moment of weakness, right? Okay? He refers to her in his mind, right? There's an all-knowing author who knows what everybody is thinking. And it says, Vayechashveha lezona. He thinks she's a zona, which is taboo in every society always. Mm-hmm. Right? But when he wants to pay for her hire, he calls her a kadesha. Hmm. Kadesha for a Canaanite, because remember, he's talking to Canaanites here. A kadesha for a Canaanite is not taboo at all. In fact,
what's the difference?
Well, to an Israelite, there's no difference. Parshas Kisetse forbids one after the other. Loya Kadesha of Israel. Kadesha may be even worse than a Zona in Israel. Because Kadesha is doing it for fertility ritual and making a bracha. And, you know, she's doing it as part of a temple ritual. Maybe even Avodah Zarah. The other woman is just business. You know, it's like the oldest profession. All right? The Kadesha to a Canaanite is, you know, everybody goes to a Kadesha, right?
55,000 of the priests of Hophni and Phinehas, according to the Midrash, right?
Right, so they were familiar with the Kadesha. Okay. All right, so when he suggests to her for a business transaction, she says, what are you going to pay me? So he doesn't have what to pay her on the spot. I think they dealt with animals back then. But he doesn't have to pay her. So he goes, she knows who he is. But he doesn't know who she is. And she knows that when it comes to family matters, he hasn't been straight with me. He told me that he's going to give me his third son. He said, wait here, keep your mourning, your widow's clothes on until my third son is old enough. Right? He has, the biblical text itself tells us that he has no intention of actually doing so. So then again, let her go. At this early time in history, I don't know what kind of mechanism, like chalitza, is available. But let her go. Just make an official statement. You're no longer tied to my family. No, you know, take off a shoe or something and spit on the ground. Whatever, I don't know. Whatever ended up being the permission of the woman to go free, right? Called chalitza. Instead, he keeps her. She's the worst of both worlds. She's waiting, which may be worthwhile if there's something at the end of the line, but there is nothing at the end of the line, and she begins to sense that, right? So this man isn't trustworthy to her. So if you're going to promise me to give me something, I want... Now remember the word that he used to Yaakov.
Yeah.
Erevenu. So imtitain eravon ad sholchecha, she says in Pasuk Yud-Ches. Perhaps you would, before I agree to this transaction, perhaps you would give me something to hold on to before you pay me my salary. So he gives her, and she suggests easily identifiable material: your driver's license, credit card, and your passport. Right? Okay. So she's holding on to his stuff. Okay, and it calls it in titain eravon ad shlachecha. Right. Okay, So he goes and he wants to pay up, right, and to redeem his passport and his driver's license. So he says, where was the Kadesha that was in here? So when the Kadesha is in a town, everybody's got to know it. Everybody knows a Kadesha. A Zona, maybe not so much, but a Kadesha. So he goes, there was no Kadesha in this town. He goes, what? Now, you see, he wants to get his stuff back, right? So, you know, he does have an option. You could say, what about a Zona? Was there a Zona in town? Now, he doesn't go that far, but somebody would say, no. She was not a, you know, as far as we understand, she was just there for, she was targeting Yehuda. She was looking for him. She was at the Ayin, you know, the crossroads. So she says, listen, he has three sons. I killed two of them. You know what I mean. I've survived two of them. He's not giving me the third. So I'm stuck with this family. Oh, I get back to the family through him. All right. So she does. She does what other women in Bereishis and really, frankly, in elsewhere in Tanakh, is they take over family matters from men who are, I might even call recalcitrant. It's Rus who really has to push Rus and Naomi together, Mistama, who have to push Boaz. Hey, Boaz, how many more? What more does someone have to do before you get the picture here? Right? Okay, so, of course, Rivka sets Yitzchak straight, Sarah sets Avram straight, right? As I've said a number of times, the only reason why in this generation things don't go straight, they really don't, certainly not, you know, worse than the other generations, because there's no Rochel to set Yosef straight. Right? Mm-hmm. Death of Rochel is extremely tragic in terms of what it might have prevented. Right? Okay. All right. So that's the word Eravon, is that Yehuda knows how to take responsibility, but more important, how to convince those around him. That's the truly the correct political thing to do. This is politics. This is, you know, how can I be convincing? So taking responsibility is convincing, right? So true. Yes, Chazal say that what he did in the story of Tamar made it known that he is worthy of kingship, right? And then, now, in our story, he's going to challenge Yosef. Right? He challenges the one who goes taking his own position of leadership too far. Okay. All right. So let's go back now back to Perek Mem Gimel. So he says, so that keep in mind that word ervenu. I will take responsibility for him. It's top of page 110. Anochi ervenu miyodi tivakshenu. Miyodi tivakshenu. Remember, esachai ani mevakesh. Remember that? Right? Im lo havi osive lecha v'yitzaktiv lefanecha v'chatosi lecha kol hayamim. If I don't bring him back, and I just like place him before you. Right? V'chatosi lecha kol hayamim. Now, why is this more convincing than Yehuda? V'chatasi l'cha kol ha'yamim means
I'll...
Reuven, yes. Yeah, well, he's saying that I will be forever... I mean, come on, Yehuda, you are forever...
Guilty
in, before you, his father just doesn't know it. But you were the one responsible for his sale. Now, you, in deference to Yehuda, you can say, no, he's the one responsible that he's alive. Right? Reuven was not there to protect Yosef. Somehow he left, because it says he came back and found Yehuda and found Yosef was not in the pit.
Yeah.
Where did he go?
So he came back after he was thrown to the pit. And they were sitting down to
No, well, when Reuven said, let's not, they wanted to kill him right away. Right?
No, but then he put him in the why did he kill him? Let's just leave him there.
So they said, here comes the dreamer. Let's kill him and just throw him into one of the pits. Right? We'll bury him here.
Who said that?
Right? No one, all of them, Ishel Achiv. And we'll say that the wild animal ate him. We'll see what happens to his dreams. Reuven listened and he saved them. He said, don't shed blood. Right. Let's just throw him into one of the pits and let our hands not be on him. In other words, they wanted to kill him, throw him in a pit. Reuven said, no, we shall not be the ones to shed blood. Let's throw him in the pit. And the assumption is, he'll die in the pit. Let our hands not kill him. Now, that's what the brothers thought Reuven meant. The reader is made privy to what he actually meant because it gives you a little parenthesis. Laman havioso, right, in order to bring him home to his father. Reuven felt inadequate in actually expressing those thoughts to his brothers because he thought he could not convince them of this. Mm-hmm. Said, if I say I'm going to take him home, right? They won't let me. Right? Okay, so you're the bechor, you take responsibility. No, he's not able to. Okay, so they put him in the pit, right? And it doesn't say. And then Reuven went to Mishamish's father. Reuven went it just says, the Medrash says that it was his turn to look over Yaakov. Otherwise, his eyes wouldn't have departed from Yosef. Right? That's the Medrash. I don't know why he wasn't there all that time, but he wasn't. He comes back to find a pit missing Yosef. Right? Okay. So that is the contrast with Reuven, because Yehuda is able to convince the brothers for what he wants to be done. Yehuda is able to say this. No, he's our brother. Remember, he uses the word Achim twice. He's our brother. Let's get something out of it. You get the difference here? Yehuda is able to convince them that this is what we all want to do. Right? Reuven, that's Yehuda. Reuven was not able to convince the brothers what he wanted to do. And that's why he's not Melech. You know, go swing all the way over to David the Melech. David is forced, before he becomes king of all of Israel, to make some very unpopular decisions in Israel, amongst his people. Remember when he has to convince the 600 men with him to share the spoils with those who went to battle, those who didn't, right? Remember when the people from Amalek took the captives, he has to make some very unpopular decisions, but he makes them, right? As opposed to Shaul, who every decision he makes has to have a focus group. What do the people think about this? What's going to be popular with the people? Now, I think that in some format, that's important. You should have town hall meetings, and you should see what's on the people's minds, and that's a good way to run a kingdom. But the people don't, the popular vote does not always get it right. That's why we have representative government. You know, we trust some very, very learned special people to help us, you know, help make the right decisions for us. And then if we don't like those decisions, we'll vote them out soon. Okay, so that's the difference between Yehuda and Reuven, and why Yehuda takes the kingdom from Reuven. Okay? But poor Reuven, Yehuda takes the kingdom from him, and Yosef takes the Bechorah from him. and then, according to Rashi, who says that the Bechorah, it's not a stretch, the Bechorim, it says a few times in the Torah, especially in the Parshas Bamidbar, that the Bechorim were meant to be the holy, right, the Am Kadosh. Right? And it switched over to Shevet Levi. Mm-hmm. Right? So Reuven loses the Bechorah of the double portion to Yosef. He loses the Bechorah of Malchus to Yehuda. And he loses the Bechorah of the Avodah to Levi. Right? Because we cannot have a Pachas Kamayim doing any of these things. All right, okay, let's go back now and see. Perek Mem Gimel, back to where we were. Okay. So he says, Anochi Arvenu Miyadiyah Tevakshenu, if I don't bring him back. Ki lulei yismamonu, ki ato shavnu zeh pa'amayim. Right, we could have been back twice. And Yaakov accepts this. He accepts this, I mean, his time is passing. Maybe if Reuven came to him and said, take my two sons and kill them at this point, he'd say, you know, Reuven, that sounds really stupid, but we're all starved. Okay, go. I can't tell. This is what I would suggest. Is Yehuda has a very good reason to personally take responsibility so that Yaakov does not lose a second son of Rachel. Mm-hmm. Because I have already lost two sons. You get it? He says, I have no, you have not lost any other grandchildren. Right? It says all their names that they were when they were born. It says all their, look, it could be, maybe some were lost, but we're not told of anything. Yehuda has lost two children, two out of three children. Yeah. Right? And then the two are replaced because he behaves responsibly. Mm. Right? The whole world is for Yehuda is standing in the balance as he may be able to. Well, if she's holding on to his passport and his driver's license, what else is he going to say? Right? But I will tell you this. At this early time in history, whether it's Yosef against Potiphar's wife, or whether it's Yehuda against Tamar, it is a who would believe you over me kind of world. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right? Which is thankfully changing. Right? That is, so that's where, I think where you, so when Yehuda admits and he says, Tzadka Mimeni, so that's again, David in contrast to Shaul, where David, when confronted with guilt throughout Sefer Shmuel Bet, he takes it on the chin and he accepts it. Shaul, thinking himself so perfect, can't accept that he's not. Right? And Chazal, in a very amazing Gemara in the beginning of the second parak in Maseches Yuma, says that David was not the moral specimen that Shaul was. Ben Shaul b'molcho. The Gemara makes a drash that he was as innocent as a 1 year old. He was so pure and so innocent.
Abigail, when she spoke to David, she put him in place.
Yes, and he admits it. A very different midrashim about how she put him in his place. Either one, because you're not king yet, and you have no chutzpah to act this way as if though you are king.
That's a Gemara. Would have become king.
Correct. Yes. In fact, that's why the Gemara in Megillah Daf Yudalit says she was one of the prophetesses, because she knew that. Right? There was even another medrash that appears similar to this in Medrash Shocher Tov, in Perek Yudal, in Masechet Shocher Tov. It says, that's the Medrash Tatel. It says that she came out to him and said, oh, David, Melech Yisrael, Chai V'Kayam, and she's saying, you are king, O King David. He goes, still you don't have the right to kill my husband. You see, in the Gemara, it would appear, you would have the right to kill my husband for his insolent behavior, but you're not king. If you were king, you'd have the right. In the other form, in Medrash Tehillim, she calls him king. And she says the king still does not have the right. It seems that the Shocher Tov is much later than the Gemara, that it evolved an opinion that, no, you know what? The king does not have this kind of power to say, give me food, and if you don't, I'm out. What are you running?
Even as king.
All right, but that's There are different opinions in the second parak in Masechet Sanhedrin on this very issue. All right, so but you see the behavior of Yehuda emerging as someone who is going to merit this this kind of behavior, right? That to deserve to be king, right? Okay, so when Yaakov when Yaakov gives the permission to go, he says, you know, it's just go. And he says, Ve'el Shaddai, Pasuk Yudal, Yitain Lachem Rachamim Lifnei Ha'ish, V'shilach Lachem Esachichem Acher, V'es Binyamin. He doesn't even mention Shimon. He says, he'll get your other brother and Binyamin, Va'ani Kasher Shacholti, Shacholti. Like I have lost, Shacholti is a specific Hebrew word for losing children.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Remember that? When Rivka told him, why should I be bereft of both of you and you and Esav on the same day? Okay.
Oh.
Okay. Like when Esther said, Kasher Avadati Avadati. Remember that?
Yeah.
Where the Yeshua there comes from the only one who can say he's not responsible for all this.
Mm-hmm. Is that the same root as shekel?
No, that's with a kuf.
That's a kuf?
It's a shekel. Yeah.
Yeah, this is a machine kuf.
Okay. So there's a rehabilitation of brothers here. The Yehuda and Yosef play a role together. Those are the two trees we just read about in last week's Haftarah. We're paying attention, right? One tree was for Yehuda, one tree was for Ephraim. And those are the two trees that are two kingdoms. Those were the two trees in the Haftorah of Shabbos Chanukah also, the two trees leading into the two sides of the menorah. Mm-hmm. And they are the two Mashiachs, Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David. Right? And that's how Sefer Bereishis is coming to resolution. So in the beginning of our parsha, Yaakov, this is how some of the Ashkenazic Mefarshim present it, Yaakov feels very uncomfortable. He's asking Yosef to do something he himself didn't do. I'm asking you to take my body to the family plot, even though I didn't take your mother's body to the family plot.
Mm.
Right? Now, there could be many reasons for doing so, Kabbalistically, so that she could be on the road with...
Right.
Face and Israel would pass because Yirmiyahu refers to Rachel crying for her descendants. It could be because if she died, you know, there is a very well known custom in Halacha that certainly at that time, because I'll say she died in Cheshvan, but that where a person dies, that's where you bury them. You don't go traveling, you don't go jumping from one place to another. It was still on the other side of Beis Lechem. Kibbutz Eretz Levor Frata. It was somewhere in the Yarden. So I didn't take your mother. It was a family plot by that time, right? If someone dies in Be'er Sheva, they're going to take the body of the Chevron. Why did? Because your mother died in childbirth. We had to just, you know. It wasn't good to take her so a distance, a few days distance. We had to bury her right on the spot. Right? There are. I'm sure you know the halacha nebuch. They do this. Zaka does this. A terrorist attacks. If someone is killed on a bus, they have to bury even the chair he was killed on together with him. Everything that had, you know.
Like
they do if someone dies in the hospital room. They bury the sheets with them, bury the tubes, they bury everything.
What is it, time distance? Or
in case there's blood?
Time distance or a distance?
They're both, time and place. So she died in childbirth, you know, she's saying, so whatever the excuse is, Yosef, I didn't do what you probably thought I should have done. Bury mommy with everybody else in the family. But I didn't. And still I'm asking you,
To take me
to the family plot. And I know it's not going to be easy. So Yaakov is smart. He asks him to swear. What's the swear? So he can tell Paro. You know, Paro, I know, you know, I have a lot of affairs of state to run. I know a lot of things to do. But my father made me swear. I have to do it. Swearing is big by us.
Mm.
Okay? So, yes, Moshe?
Yeah, okay, so she was buried on the road? I mean, it worked out well by...
Kivrat Eretz, Lavor Efrata. Now, if that place is where Kevar Rachel is today, so be it.
So that place was
I'm not going to get involved. If the Israeli government says that that's where Rachel is buried, okay. I don't think so.
It's long before the Israeli government.
What?
Of course, that was recognized long before these.
Yes, yes. The Muslims built things there. You see all the mother. You see the mother. A lot of Arabic writing all over Kibbutz Ochel. Have you ever seen what I'm talking about? You been there recently? It's a fortress now, but.
Some Kohanim go there because they say she's
But Jews
really
came to the oven there. For
yeah, the but I got to tell you, she's buried in Beis Lechem Binyamin, not Beis Lechem Yehuda. And she's buried north of Israel. And I mean, in the story of how Shaul became king, it says he passed over in Tzeltzach, the Eretz Binyamin, in Kfurat Rachel. Tzeltzach is north of, is near where Shmuel is buried. You know, near Ramot, have you seen it? I'm just saying.
The present site was dated as hers, though, for a long time.
Yeah,
no doubt.
But it would make very little sense for the Babylonians to march us south through Beis Lechem Yehuda on our way up to Babel. All right, but I'm not going to go there now. So Yaakov is telling him, here's Yosef. You're doing something extraordinary for me. I'm doing something extraordinary for you. I'm giving you two tribes. I'm giving you Shechem Echad al Achecha. Right? It's a good deal? Okay. Bury me in Israel. Yes.
Would it have been possible to unbury Rahel and bury her somewhere else?
Such things are done. If you're asking like a Yerodea kind of question, yes, someone is allowed to be exhumed in order to be buried in a family plot, or to be buried in Israel, or because there's some destructive force coming through that area. Yes. Yes. I guess it wasn't... maybe by that time, she was buried, it was already a shrine or something. Right? But Lamaisa, Yaakov is telling him, because otherwise, why does he have to bring up where he buried Rachel? Just say, Yosef, it's your father talking, I need you to bury me in the family plot. You're the one with the right, with the ability to do so, and the power to do so. Do it. What does he have to bring up Rachel for?
They never took her out, maybe? And that's why he's bringing her up? Because he could bury her also? She's a part of him?
What do you mean they never?
I say, they never unburied her? Is it possible that maybe they went to exhume her? And when he said, bury me in the family plot, they mentioned her. Maybe that's an allusion. That, you know.
I'm not aware of any such measures like that.
Just like I buried Rachel, you should bury me.
Okay, all right, but I can bury her where you'd like me to. I'm sure he'll give me a nice funeral here in Egypt, but I want a funeral in Israel. Okay, all right, so this is the resolution of Bereishis. It is, according to Chazal, we still need resolution on Yom Kippur because, you know, we read about the Sarah Hugin Malchus in Yom Kippur, which starts off with the Yosef story, because the story is not fully resolved.
No one ever says, I forgive you.
Right, and the brothers still think that he's going to kill them
after
Yaakov dies, and that's a very sad part of the story.
To me, that means that, at least part of it means that they couldn't themselves feel clean of what they had done, which I could understand.
Which is, yeah.
How could they ever forget what they did?
Yeah. Yosef is like any good sapiential literature story, which tells how we deal with life's rough edges and tumbling and stumbling, where Yosef turns every negative into a positive. Yosef certainly excuses them and explains them and says, "I've long ago made my peace with what you did, and you were part of." Of a necessary element in my life and in the life of our people, but it doesn't seem to say he's very magnanimous with them after they make that claim. Right? But I think, really, guys, you really think I'd today cough for 17 years? I've been waiting for my dish of vengeance to be cold, right? Have you heard that? Vengeance is a dish best served cold.
Yeah.
So, okay. But so ends Sefer Bereishis, and it ends with Yosef's two sons getting switched, right, with the hand going over the right and the left. And Menashe accepts it. Yosef is not happy with it, but Menashe seems to accept it. So that's an important kapara for Bereishis. At least finally, you know, Menashe isn't trying to kill Ephraim for this, right? And this time it's almost arbitrary. Menashe says, okay, I'm not going to sell him. I'm not going to throw him into a pitch. I'm not going to, you know. Right? Okay, Chavra, that so ends...
It's the grandfather that does it, and not the father.
Maybe. Who am I to disagree with what Zevi does? But it certainly wouldn't be right for, say, grandfather is distributing his will and he picks two grandchildren to give him and leaves out the other 20. It doesn't seem right. But Yaakov, like Yosef, is a Navi and he knows what it's going to be. Okay, Chavra, have a Marv.
You're not going to be here the next two.
Next, yes, next week. No, the week after. I have weddings. And then we're 2 years, 2 weeks in Israel. So the next class is January 22nd.
Wow, it's almost a month. 4 weeks. Sorry, yes.